So what I want to address tonight is, and I admit it was kind of a bold topic, right? The future of God. Did anybody think? Oh, but it's really about where religion and spirituality, the human quest for meaning, is going now at the dawn of the third millennium. It's about, in a sense, what I think we could maybe say is an inquiry into the meaning of life and the purpose of life in our time, which may have changed a bit from some earlier times. So, you see, here at the beginning of the 21st century, those of us who, I think includes everybody in this room, those of us who I guess I would say are at the progressive edge of culture on the planet, are in a really interesting predicament. You see, we are, these first few things I'm going to say pretty much refer to everybody today in the civilized world. But we now have a level of uncertainty, complexity, change facing us that no generation in history has had anything, has ever experienced anything like. We're at a time that everything that humans have been through up to this point really does very little to prepare us for where we are now. I mean, let's take socially, for instance, on a social level. Even a couple of generations ago, from a young age, you were born, you knew what you were going to do for your whole life, pretty much, probably the same thing your father did. Women certainly knew what they were going to do for their whole life. And there was a kind of social stability. You were going to stay in touch with your family for the rest of your life, be very close, have a close-knit group of friends. It was all pretty much laid out. And that carried out through your life. Now, most of us will live in many different cities over the course of our lives, be recreating community and social relationships again and again and again, many times over. Half of us will get divorced and remarried. The nuclear family no longer provides a very meaningful context for many of us. Half of adults now live alone. Many of us only see our parents or children once a year. We're all dealing with an unprecedented level of diversity in our workplaces. Used to be you worked with people who all saw the world pretty much the same way you did. Pretty much everybody you knew saw the world the same way you did. Now we've got all different sects, belief systems, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism now in America, all different ways of seeing the world mixing together. On a technological level, just going to take a poll. How many people are struggling slightly to keep up with the rate of technological change? Really? It must just be folks in Chaffee County. I think everybody else is fine with this. The speed of technological change today is requiring a level of adaptability that humans have never had to manifest. And just to put it in a little bit of context, our Paleolithic ancestors used the same set of stone tools for 1.5 million years. You were born, you had the set of tools. You died, you had the set of tools. Generation after generation for 1.5 million years. Even you go back 150 years, the technology was relatively static. A little before that, there was, unless you happened to be around at the invention of the plow or the printing press, things were pretty much, you'd live your whole life with basically the same technology. Look at your own lifetime. How many new sets of tools have you had to adapt to? Look at the last 5 years, how many new sets of tools? Now, most of us know that things are changing fast. But how many of us are aware that the rate of change itself is accelerating? You see, this is something it takes a little bit to get your head around. But what's actually happening with technology right now is that the speed at which information can be processed is going up at an exponential rate. And what that's amounting to is that it becomes increasingly hard to predict the future based on where things are today. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, nobody in this room has any idea what the world's going to be like in 5 years. And and take that forward 20 years, even if you were to just project a straight line up at the rate things are going now, it'd be hard to know what's going to happen in 5 years, because look how much has just happened in the last couple years of technology. But that line is going like this. And techno-futurists are very fond of this notion they call the singularity, which is the point at which the rate of change is going to be so fast that it's going to be impossible to predict the technology of tomorrow, tomorrow meaning Saturday, based on the technology of today. And they're convinced that this is going to happen by like 2045. So for those of us who are going to be around then, you think things are changing fast now. Hold on. So again, we're being stretched to develop a kind of flexibility and adaptability that really humans have never been prepared for. We're also confronted by global scale issues with global scale uncertainties attached to them, such as overpopulation, the industrialization of the third world now, where we're going to have billions more consumers consuming at the level we've all been consuming pretty soon on a planet with limited resources. We've got the rapid deterioration of the biosphere, which sustains us, the potential for a worldwide epidemic. And of course, now we've all kind of woken up to the fact that there's a climate crisis, which is really only the most visible iceberg tip of this larger environmental crisis. And all of that is forcing us to consider some potentially radical lifestyle changes. We're not sure. Maybe technology will save the day. Maybe it won't. Hard to know. All of this is stretching us to think and feel beyond our little world, beyond any kind of scale we're accustomed to thinking on. We have to now start to think as a planet. We have to start to literally think as a global village and figure out how we all are going to get through the immense changes that are already beginning. In the midst of all this, though, the biggest challenge, and the one that I'm really here to focus on tonight, is that we've lost what we might call our collective compass. You see, religion used to tell us how to navigate life. Life was pretty simple not all that long ago. You were born, told this is how it all is, it's in the book. Read the book, that's how you live. And that information worked for a while. But you see, all of the world's traditions, the world's great religious traditions that have provided human beings with guidance on how to navigate the complexity of life, emerged at a time when life was nothing like it is today. Life was so much simpler. And I think many people today in the traditions are finding, even those who maintain a deep loyalty to their traditions, are finding that the tradition itself, in its traditional form that's being carried into the 21st century, does not really provide them all the adequate guidance that they need to get to find their way through the complexities of their life. For instance, what great prophet of the past, no matter how enlightened, could have told us how to relate to a climate crisis, how to relate to a mass extinction in which we're losing probably half the species on the planet as a result of human influence? This was not all the great prophets of the religions had a worldview about as big as, you know, their village, maybe their country, but there was no sense of a planetary context. There was no sense of the kind of time scale we're having to relate to life on. But an even bigger issue is that for many of us, for most of us really at this point, the great myths of the past no longer inspire us as reliable accounts of reality. Certainly not reliable accounts enough to base our lives on. There's been this great shaking off of the ancient dogmas that has had basically two parts to it. The first one was what's known as the scientific revolution, the Western Enlightenment. A few hundred years back, there was this big battle against the church, and the scientists won and came out and said, look, we are no longer going to be beholden to your world of private revelation, something that somebody got the word from God, put it in a book, and we all have to believe this is true, and we have to go through you, the church, to understand truth. We're going to move into the arena of public revelation, we're going to together look and find out what we can discover and understand about reality in public and test our theories against each other's experiments. And this was the great birth of science. And it dealt a heavy blow to the idea that the church was the sole source of authority. The second one was postmodernism, which, I don't want to just use a big word on y'all, but put it simply, this was the insight early last century that any inquiry we have into truth, including scientific inquiry, doesn't matter, that in any inquiry into truth, we are limited in our ability to see clearly. We're limited by cultural lenses that we're all wearing, whether we like it or not, that we probably can't be entirely aware of. And so, in a sense, this was the sort of death knell of truth with a capital T, and the birth of something that we're all pretty familiar with now, which is the idea that, well, we can't really quite know what's ultimately true, so we just all have our own perspective. You might have even heard language like, well, you have your truth, and I have my truth. This is a product of this breakthrough in our way of understanding ourselves and how we make meaning out of life. Now, from my point of view, both of these have been fantastic. These are great insights, and they have freed human beings in ways we've never been freed. We've been freed from having to believe things that don't really make any sense to us. We've been freed from having to look out having to take somebody else's word for what's true. And in the absence of this larger unifying context, I have to say that many of us have done a very good job of figuring out how to make meaning out of life for ourselves. We've done our introspection. The existentialists were great at saying, you know, you're alone in this. Figure it out for yourself. And that's had a big influence on Western culture and on all of us. And we're doing pretty well with it, finding our own way. Even many of us kind of inventing our own spiritual paths now, dabbling a little from Buddhism, a little from Kabbalah, a little from mystical Christianity, etc. Put it all together and kind of try to find our way to a meaningful life. But what many of us are discovering is that this freedom to think as we feel, think as we please, freedom to make meaning and value entirely on our own, has come with a price. And that price is that we as a whole have lost a larger unifying context in which to come together and understand our place here, which religion used to provide beautifully. And it's pretty much gone now. I mean, if you're lucky, you can find a little group of people who you sort of more or less see things similarly with, that you can kind of explore life together and make meaning together. But by and large, this larger unifying moral context, meaning-making context, mythic context is gone. And to be honest, this is why a lot of us feel a sense of fragmentation and isolation. Even if we're doing really well in life and everything's going great, there's often a sense of sort of like, I feel kind of on my own. Because frankly, in a world where truth is relative, where we have no way of knowing what's ultimately true, we are ultimately alone in our own universe. I also feel that in this great shaking off of religion, that we've, by and large, lost the sacred. And what I mean by the sacred is not just a positive feeling of that maybe God exists, but a sense of something so much bigger than us that it brings us to our knees, a sense of the holy. It's largely been sort of brushed aside. So, in looking at this question, the future of God, what I'm really trying to go into is how can we resurrect this sense of the sacred within a scientifically enlightened, post-mythic, post-modern worldview? How can we discover a unifying context of meaning and purpose that is actually based not on somebody's private revelation, but on the realm of public revelation that we can all come together and agree on? And how can we find higher guidance for how to live our lives within this realm of scientifically revealed, mutually agreed upon knowledge? In our enlightened scientific age, can we find a new myth that imbues life with a sense of higher meaning, a meaning beyond ourselves, even beyond humanity itself? Is there a story we can locate within a scientific worldview that's captivating enough, compelling enough to magnetize us toward the highest human possibilities? You see, although it may be true that, as postmodernity has taught us, that we can't ultimately be completely sure that what we're seeing is true, we have to always leave some level of doubt and uncertainty there. I think that over these last few hundred years of scientific inquiry, we've learned quite a lot that we can all agree on at this point. Quite a lot that's been verified from enough angles to say, okay, we'll take this as true. And it's my opinion that if we look at it closely, there's a profound pattern that's starting to emerge from pretty much all the sciences that contains all the elements that we need to create, to discover a new universal and even sacred context of meaning and purpose for human life. I believe it can also teach us a lot about how to live our lives in the face of the chaos and uncertainty that I was just describing. That pattern, in a word, is evolution. You see, when we step back from all the sciences and social sciences, we see a similar picture emerging. Development over time, progressive upward development over eons of time. And my talk tonight is going to explore what does this emerging knowledge of evolution, this knowledge that we live in an unfolding, evolving universe, tell us about the meaning and purpose of human life and about how we should be living. Now, what I'm going to speak about is what's known as a deep time perspective. It's a perspective on life and our place in the world that takes us all the way back to the beginning and all the way forward as to where we might be going and tries to take it all in. And if we take what's known as a deep time perspective and we look at what's been unfolding for the last 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang, it starts to look like a great, immense, epic story of evolution and creation that really, frankly, in my opinion, trumps any of the great creation myths of any of the world's traditions. I mean, it's awe-inspiring what's been going on since that Big Bang. And what makes this particular story all the more significant is that it's not just one that was delivered to us by a prophet or the dream of the village elder. It's based on what we've collectively been able to discern about our origins through science, public revelation. So what is this epic story, this new myth that I'm so fired up about? I like the way a cosmologist friend of mine named Brian Swim sums it up. He says, you take a great cloud of hydrogen gas and you leave it alone. And it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings. To go into a little more detail, to the best of our knowledge, 13.7 billion years ago and a day, we were what was known as a singularity, a different kind than the one I was speaking about before. It wasn't nothing, but all the matter in the current universe was condensed into a single point, a tiny, almost immeasurable single point contained the whole thing. And we were all there then. Get it? We had to be. Everything that's here came out of that singularity. I'm not asking you to remember it, but as I'm speaking, you might get some little inkling. So suddenly, the next day, 13.7 billion years, out of this singularity, this universe just explodes into being. just a firestorm that we couldn't even imagine in its immensity just blows out. And interestingly, it only takes about 1 million years for this initial explosion to calm down. Initially, it's just chaos. It's just fire, storm everywhere, disorganization. But after about 1 million years, it starts to settle out, and patterns start to emerge. Structure starts to happen. Initially, this amorphous cloud of burning gas starts to coalesce into these structures called galaxies. Initially, about 100 billion of them come into existence. And what these galaxies are doing, now, if you had been there standing back looking, it might not have seemed particularly purposeful. There was just, they were forming these balls. It's like things were coming in, these balls of gas were starting to burn. These were the primordial stars. And the galaxies were just starting to organize these balls of gas. And really, if you want to understand what these balls of gas were, in a sense, they were what we might think of as the sort of the first artisan colonies. Because they were up to something. You see, what happened in these balls of gas, these primordial stars that lived much shorter lives than our current stars do, is that they would get hotter and hotter. And they would get so hot that they would go into what's called a supernova, which, frankly speaking, was a kind of immense sacrifice. They would burn themselves out. But what was happening in the center of these supernova stars that were burning so intensely is that these initial elements that made up the universe, hydrogen and helium, were being fused into higher elements. In these primordial stars, in the burning bellies of these primordial stars, hydrogen and helium were being fused into carbon, oxygen, which, again, at that time, probably didn't mean very much if you were watching. But as we know now, they mean quite a lot to us. They became the building blocks for life. So out of those higher elements, particularly carbon, come the building blocks for planets to emerge, and particularly for our interest, this planet called Earth comes into existence about 4.6 billion years ago. 4.6 billion years ago. Now, from a geological perspective, what's kind of interesting about this is that in almost no time, this thing called life started to emerge. Earth's been around 4.6 billion years. Life's been here for 4 billion of those years. Now, obviously, 0.6 billion sounds like a lot, but in geological time, it was like the blink of an eye. So this business of life was quick to get going once we had a planet for it to happen on. And one thing I want to point out is that, you see, it didn't actually have to be this way. See, theoretically, we could have just had a dead universe. Well, there's no particular reason why you'd have to have life, right? But as it turns out, this particular universe appears to have been set up in just such a way that life could actually exist. And I just want to put a little caution here. I'm not tonight talking at all about anything remotely resembling intelligent design, okay? From my point of view, intelligent design is essentially creationism in drag. And that's not what I mean at all. So, no offense to anybody who believes in intelligent design or creationism, but I hope you take these thoughts into consideration. But what I'm saying here, this is not at all in dispute. I'm not bringing you fringe science here. This is something that astronomers, astrophysicists all agree on, which is that if you look at the basic constants of our universe, the universe seems to be finely tuned for the emergence of life. There's a book called Just Six Numbers by the British Royal Astronomer Sir Martin Rees. And he takes what are basically the six constants that define the basic laws of our universe and shows that if any one of these basic laws were only fractionally different. Life would not be possible. And for the scientists here, I'll go through a few of these. The rest of you just go ahead and space out for a sec because it's going to be nothing to you. But for example, if what's known as the nuclear strong force were only slightly stronger, by as little as 1%, hydrogen would be extremely rare in the universe. And elements heavier than iron would also be rare. And if it were slightly weaker, hydrogen would be the only element in the universe. So there would not have been the possibility of this fusion that we had. If the nuclear weak force were only slightly larger, neutrons would decay more readily and be less available, and no helium would have been produced by the Big Bang. So we wouldn't have had the other part of the cocktail for the fusion that brought the higher elements into existence. If that force were only slightly smaller, the Big Bang would have burned most or all of the hydrogen into helium. So we wouldn't have had the hydrogen part. So life as we know it wouldn't be possible. If the nucleon-to-nucleon interaction were even 0.4% different, there wouldn't be enough carbon in the universe for life as we know it to exist. And it goes on through three others. But anyway, that's the basic point. It's not in dispute at all. What is in dispute is whether that means anything. And of course, you've got scientists on both sides, though, saying, of course, well, that's all very interesting, but it must mean that there are an infinite number of other universes in which no life exists, which means that the fact that life, our universe, happens to be finely tuned for life is obviously itself just a random occurrence in billions of universes. This is what's known as inflation theory. But as yet, no one has actually seen another universe, but it does help you maintain a belief that the whole thing's meaningless if that's what you are committed to doing. It's also possible that for some intelligent reason, life had a purpose. So here you have this universe finely tuned for life. And then what happens? In what we might call the second Big Bang, the Big Bang of life, this explosion of immense cosmological creativity that was going on a material level, on a galactic level, it now morphs into an even more brilliant explosion of biological creativity. This immense upsurge from bacteria to ponderosa pines to rainbow trout to armadillos to cougars to human beings. This explosion of biological diversity ultimately gives rise to some 50 million different species. Just creativity in motion. And when we look at this amazing life process of unfolding evolution, what becomes clear is that it also didn't have to be this way. It's feasible that we could have just accidentally gotten life, that initial bacteria in the primordial soup, and it would have just stayed bacteria for another 4.5 billion years, right? No particular reason why it had to do something other than just be bacteria, but it didn't. It's been an immense creative flowering of beauty and diversity. And one of the reasons, by the way, that evolutionary theory has been so thoroughly knocked by maybe perhaps fundamentalist religionists, but I think a lot of people who are religious worry a bit about evolutionary theory because it seems so materialistic, so pointless and meaningless, and could the whole thing really be random? And then what does any of it mean if it was all random? But one of the reasons that this theory has been knocked so strongly is that certain influential evolutionary biologists made a really strong case for this idea of randomness. One of them was Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, who died a few years ago. See, he was famous for his assertions that evolution was completely random. And the way he would sort of back this assertion up is he would say, well, if you don't think it's random, let's imagine that we were to rewind the tape of evolution. Let's go back to the beginning, set up the same initial causes, and get that bacteria going in the soup, and then let it go again. Do you think it would unfold in exactly the same way? No, it would unfold in some different way. So therefore, obviously, it's all random, right? Well, the true answer we now know is yes and no. You see, we probably wouldn't have the same exact species. But if we look at what's known in evolutionary biology as convergent evolution, what we find is that there were certain very particular traits that were going to show up no matter what, because they showed up along parallel lines over and over again. For instance, wings to fly. Now, one might think, oh, well, maybe those just were an accident and they happened once and then they went from one species to another. But in fact, wings evolved independently about four different times in flies, birds, pterosaurs, and bats. No relation whatsoever, they just came into being. The hydrostatic penis, which inflates through an infusion of fluid, evolved independently in mammals, like us, and turtles. So guys, those are your cousins. So, sex was bound to happen. Image-sensing eyes, like ours, evolved independently 60 different times. Completely different lines. And there are hundreds of other examples of traits like this that evolved independently. So given this, it's pretty clear that although if we rewound the tape, we wouldn't probably have the exact same world we have now. It's kind of a fun experiment to imagine what it might have been like. We can be pretty sure it would have most of the same characteristics. There's one exception. The human mind only evolved once. But we don't know that it wouldn't come about again. So, and I think particularly it's important to see that the laws of life did seem to be set up such that the universe would evolve eyes to see itself. So this creative unfolding of life is humming along for about 4 billion years. And then, just the blink of an eye, back in history, about 4 million years ago, one of these animals, one of these primates, descends from the trees and gives a go at standing up on 2 feet. And initially, things didn't speed up all that much. You had these early hominids roaming around the savanna for, again, millions of years. And there was no really significant change for them. Like I mentioned earlier, some of them used these same stone tools over and over for 1.5 million years. So it wasn't like that suddenly, once we got on 2 feet and got hands that could use tools, it became this explosion of innovation. It was pretty slow moving. But about 50,000 years ago, something dramatic occurred in this unfolding of life. It's what's known by many evolutionary scientists as the mind's Big Bang. This is the moment when we look back in the geological record, when we suddenly find, and it was quite sudden, we suddenly find this beautiful, dramatic artwork appearing on the cave walls. We suddenly find in people's graves that we uncover, we find that they're putting flowers on the body, on the skeletons of the dead. We find ornate beads appearing, apparently being used in particular configurations to try to indicate some sense of identity, some sense of I am a person with a place in the world. This is the moment when human creativity is born. And it's also the moment when what's known as reflexive consciousness or reflective consciousness is born. When humans start to try to come to grips with their place in the whole, with who we are, what we are, life, death. And this is what frankly is the birth of culture. And what happens in this Big Bang is that the evolutionary dynamics that had initially been unfolding cosmologically in the celestial evolution, that then morphed into biological evolution in its creative display, they now move into what's known as cultural evolution. And we see through the human, this evolutionary process now begins to take on a completely another order of creativity, of innovation. From hunter-gatherer to agrarian to industrial, to the information age. From the papyrus to the printing press, to the telephone, to the internet. From the hand axe to the plow, to the crane. From the horse and buggy to the automobile, to the space shuttle. From the cave paintings to the pyramids, to Shakespeare, to rap music. Okay, I probably shouldn't have included that one, sorry. But you get the idea. So evolution has been on this upward spiral, first through cosmology, then through biology, and now through culture, through human consciousness. And what's interesting is that if you step back and you look at the broad sweeps of evolution, it seems to be heading in a very specific direction through all of those different dimensions. What is that direction? Well, there may be others, but there are two pieces that we can really clearly discern. One is in the direction of greater and greater complexity. The other is greater and greater cooperation. Take biology. Cooperating groups of self-replicating molecular processes come together to form the first cells. Those individual cells eventually start cooperating with other individual cells to form larger and more complex cells. Groups of these complex cells then combine to create the first multicelled organisms. And then groups of some of those multicelled organisms, like us, start combining to form initially clans, then larger tribes, eventually cities, states, nations, and ultimately our current experiment, which is the attempt to create a global village. So if you step back and you look at what evolution's up to, it's pretty clear that it's on an arc toward greater unity and greater complexity. But with the emergence of the human, something new is really afoot under the sun. Because not only does evolution then move into the realm of culture, but with the advent of human consciousness, for the first time, the universe actually begins to wake up to its own creative power. The universe, through us human beings, develops the eyes, the mind, the awareness to begin to understand what's going on here. Not only to view and reflect on the universe, but to actually develop the instrumentation to look all the way back to the beginning. We now have telescopes that can look back and detect light from just after the Big Bang. We can look back to the beginning. And in our ability to look back, and that's just one of the many ways we can now look back, from carbon dating to myriad other ways, the universe has developed a way to consciously understand its own creative process. To discern the dynamics of evolution that have been unfolding throughout this time. So you see, the miraculous evolutionary dynamics that brought the whole thing into existence, that proceeded unconsciously to unfold this immense process of life that ultimately brought humans into existence, have now taken root in the human. And we are now the leading edge of this creative unfolding. And not only are we conscious, we know we're conscious. Not only are we evolving, we actually know we're evolving. Nobody used to know. Nobody knew we were evolving until 150 years ago. Everybody thought it was basically just either a static thing or a cyclical thing. But this idea that we were on this progressive trajectory, brand new. And what's more, not only are we headed in a particular direction, we now know we're headed in a particular direction. We can understand how it's happening, we can understand where it's going. So, from nothing, from almost nothing, came something. And the laws of that something were such that it would trend eternally in the direction of cooperation and unity and complexity. And we're the conscious reflective organ of this living universe that's on a path toward greater cooperation, unity, and complexity. Pretty amazing story. Now, I imagine that most of us here, prior to coming to this talk, have gotten on board with the idea of evolution by now. Most people have, in some way. But as it is with any new worldview, there are always a lot of holdovers from the old worldview that tend to remain intact, that aren't so easily dropped. And I'll give an example. Now, none of us ever thought for a second that we lived on a flat Earth, right? We learned early on, Earth's round. It's rotating around the sun. Okay. But would you believe that there are elements of flat Earth cosmology that still influence our experience, even though none of us ever thought that? I want you to try this experiment tonight when you go outside, out under the stars. See, if you go out under a starry sky and you look up into the sky, you have a very clear, distinct experience that you are standing on a plane looking up into the stars. It's how we all talk. Look up there, isn't that amazing? But do you realize that it could be equally true that you're actually looking down into the stars? Because from the perspective of the cosmos, this up or down thing, there isn't one. It's just going out in all directions, and we're just this spinning orb. You could be sticking out the side of the Earth, looking out at the stars, down on the bottom, looking down. Those are all equally true, but just go out and try it after the talk, you know, on your way home when you get home. You'll see that it's even hard to kind of imagine. It's a little bit of one of these paradigm shifters when you actually for a moment get the sense, I'm looking down in the stars, you suddenly want to grab the ground. Why is it that it's so hard? Because every creation myth in every culture assumed, I mean, every early culture, eons and eons, everybody assumed we were on this flat thing looking up because that was our experience. We had no way to know otherwise. It's deeply ingrained. Now, you see, this particular holdover from the flat Earth days doesn't really matter much. You can go the rest of your life thinking you're looking up into the stars, and it's not going to make a difference to anything. But in the case of evolution, there is one holdover within all of us that's profoundly influencing the way we conceive of ourselves and the way that we live our lives. You see, although evolution as an idea is something we all accept, we all still tend to think of ourselves as static entities. We think that a human being is this thing that basically was just sort of was created fully formed. It's still how, I mean, even though we can look back and say, okay, well, we know that we evolved from apes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we basically think of a human being as something that's fixed. That from that time that the modern human brain emerged 50,000 years ago, humans have basically been the same. When we look back in time, if we think back to ancient Egypt, you know, we go to the IMAX movie about Egypt and we see these people. We basically project into them ourselves and we think, oh, they're basically like us going through their lives there in ancient Egypt. Boy, it must have been rough moving those stones around. Yeah, but we think they were like us. But those who have studied the development of the human mind, human consciousness, human identity, will tell us that life back then, that what it was like to be a person, how you related to yourself, how you related to others, how you related, was completely different. Even back in the Middle Ages, it was a completely different experience of being a human. Specifically, the sense of interiority that we have, the sense of a capacity to introspect, to be sort of aware of how we feel about things, I'm angry about this, and I don't like that you didn't. And this kind of ability to reflect, particularly the ability to what's known as sort of self-authoring, this kind of new emergence that's really only been around over the last probably 100, 150 years, which is this sense of being an autonomous, self-authoring individual who's able to create their own life and choose their destiny. This is an extremely new development that we all partake in. But a person in the middle of ages didn't have a sense of self like we have. It's a hard one to get. Believe me, whenever I hear this, I was like, really? And it's kind of disconcerting. But, and again, why is that? Why is that disconcerting? Why is that so hard to get? Because every creation myth throughout time believed that humans were created fully formed. It's in the way we think. And so we think of ourselves that way too. We think, I know who I am. Here's who I am. I'm an adult now, and I'm going through my life, and we have this fixed sense of identity and sense of where we're going, and sure, we know things are going to change and different things will happen, but we fundamentally see ourselves as fixed. Now, the implications of this, if you really let them in, are profound. You see, what it means for us is that we are not, in fact, static entities. We are transitional beings. We are in a process of evolutionary development that is going somewhere. We're probably never going to know where it's going, but it's going somewhere. We haven't arrived. We'll probably never get to a place where we've arrived, but we can be darn sure that we're going to change immensely over the centuries. And to just give you a little image for this, if you draw a line, let's draw a line and call it the arrow of human evolution. And let's start that line with the emergence of the modern human brain 50,000 years ago. And let's just draw that line. Let's draw a 100,000-year line arbitrarily. This is the arrow of human evolution, 50,000 years ago to 50,000 years in the future. Where are we? Smack in the middle of this unfolding process. Now imagine that line's a 500,000-year line, still starting 50,000 years ago with the emergence of the modern human brain. Now where are we in our unfolding evolutionary process? 10% of the way. Imagine it's a million-year line. Any optimists here that think humans are going to make it a million years? I'm one. Hold on one sec. It's telling me it's about to do something to my computer. Okay. I think we're safe. Okay. Technology! I don't know how to keep up with it. So if you imagine this a million-year line of the human evolutionary process, and we're 50,000 years in, it sort of puts our life in perspective. Now, imagine humanity as a whole, as a single human being in a process of development from infancy to old age. Looking at our overall behavior objectively, if you were to just step back, you're the, let's say we're all from some other galaxy and we've come to sort of take a look at this species and how they're doing. So where would you say we are on that developmental spectrum? And I'm going to take a little poll here. We'll go in reverse. How many would say that humans are senior citizens at this point? Any hands? No. How many would say we're mature adults? How about adolescents? Any? Got a few kind souls here? A few compassionate ones? How many would say we're children? Any? Quite a handful of children? Toddlers? More? Infants? Okay. Well, it seems like the audience agrees we're somewhere between infancy and adolescence. And interestingly, this is a question that another friend of mine, Dwayne Elgin, has been asking his audiences for years. And he says that the overall answer he generally gets is that humans are in their adolescence. So I may have loaded the deck a little with my initial human arrow of evolution line, so maybe that's why we got more infancy answers. But it's not surprising that that's how we see it. I mean, if you put this in a deep time perspective, if the history of the universe were being measured on a 24-hour clock, the human brain would have been around for about 1 minute. So what's interesting about this exercise to me, though, is that when we put our attention there on this question, we all know this about ourselves. Everybody here was clear. We're not mature adults. We haven't matured as a species. Okay. My question is, have we really integrated this knowledge, this thing that we all apparently recognize plain as day when we step back and become the Martians coming to visit? Do we really live our lives in the knowledge that we are this adolescent species, at best, apparently, that is just getting started, and that we have a big job to do, which is to grow up? Do we really live our lives as if that were true? Not usually. So far, although I've said a lot, I basically have made 2 points. The first is that we are the eyes and the heart of the universe. We're the conscious, reflective organ of this immense evolutionary process that's been unfolding since the beginning of time, of these creative powers of evolution. We are those powers now become conscious of our own power and our own potential. That's my first point. The second is that we're beings in transition. We are not static. We are not fixed. And frankly, we're really just getting started at figuring out what we're supposed to be doing here. I just want to say one more thing on that last point. Are you all aware? Do you remember back to when you were a kid? And there was this sense where you would look at adults, and you were a kid, and you knew you didn't know what was going on. You were just, wow, you know, life, and you're learning all these things, and it's all so overwhelming and big and confusing. But you would look at these adults, and you'd think, wow, they really know what's going on. You can tell they're so confident, and they always tell us me how to do and how to see everything. And you had this idea that somebody really knew and had it figured out. And then did you ever reach a point, some point in your adulthood, maybe it was in your 20s, maybe it was in your 30s, where you suddenly kind of looked around and you kind of realized that you didn't know what was going on still, and nobody else seemed to either. And there's this kind of disconcerting sense that the whole thing is not really held together in the way you thought, because you thought there were these people that knew, and nobody really gets it. I think for most of us, that was actually probably a very brief window of immense insecurity, at which point we sort of went, I know what's going on. Forget all that. No, it's fine. We proceeded to act as if we know what's going on. But I think that this point I just may actually shed some light on why that's true. Because if you kind of just, just kind of like relax that whole idea that you know what's going on for a second, you just sort of sit back and kind of look around each other, you kind of, we don't really know. But it makes sense that we don't really know. Because if you really look at it, we're just this brand new thing. In this 13.7 billion year process, we're this last little minute, we're this brand new thing that just got started. And we've just been, we've been bestowed with these powers that we can't even, we don't even know how to come to grips with. Look at what we've managed to do in the last 150 years. Every time I get on an airplane, I have the same experience. We're taking off, and I'm like, how on earth is this happening? This huge chunk of metal is shooting up into the air. I mean, I hope that everybody has something in their life that still gives them that sense, because to me, it's amazing. And if we're honest, our technological evolution has so outpaced our moral evolution, our spiritual evolution, our psychological evolution, that it's getting kind of scary. Because we're developing power, we're starting to play with DNA, and we're going to create new creatures, and they're playing with artificial intelligence and saying, pretty soon we're going to be able to hook our brains up to computers, and we'll all be a million times smarter, and then we'll just upload ourselves into computers, and we'll all just go and... I mean, this is the kind of things that the technologists are actually up to out there in their labs right now. And you kind of say, yeah, but what are we going to do when we have that power? I mean, are you really thinking about the right questions right now? Like, how will it be abused? And they go, oh, don't worry. We handle that. We have an ethics committee. So, to return to where I was, so we're the conscious, reflective organ of the evolving whole, and we're beings in transition, and we've just discovered these amazing powers, and we're evolving, and we don't know what the heck we're doing. So my question is, how would we live if we took these truths to heart? What life, if we all really started to reckon with who we are, what our role in this universe is, how little we know about how to do it yet, this whole picture, how might that influence our behavior, our life choices? That's, I guess, back to the navigation question. That's what religion's supposed to help us do. How do we navigate? What can we glean from this? And before we look at some possible answers to this question, I want to point out one more thing, which is that in terms of our current stage of human evolution that those of us in this room are at, and acknowledging here that people on the planet right now are at a lot of different stages of evolution, but those of us here are in a very unique and precious moment. You see, we are the first generation in history to have the luxury to ask these kinds of questions en masse. You see, not only are we the first to really understand our place in the cosmos, to know that we're part of this unfolding evolutionary story, but we're the first to have the luxury to not be fundamentally concerned with survival, to have this kind of leisure, to be able, I mean, obviously kings used to be able to do this, and a few philosophers, but we're the first to actually not be concerned with survival, to have the freedom on a mass scale to think about higher things and consider what our larger role really is. To even ask a question like, well, gee, what actually should I be doing here as a planetary citizen? So, given that, how would we live if we knew that we were transitional beings and that evolution was now in our hands? Let's look at some of the options that are available to us. One, we could accumulate more stuff. This is what a lot of us have done, right? With our leisure time. And if we truly are the conscious organ of a living, dynamic universe, it should really come as no surprise that accumulating more dead things to surround ourselves with doesn't ultimately satisfy us, right? There's something a lot more that's supposed to be happening here, and we all feel it. Number two, we could accumulate more experiences. It's a bit more interesting, right? We could travel the world, climb the mountains, sail the seas, experience all the great art that's emerging, try new things. Now that sounds a bit more interesting, a bit more alive. But again, those of us who have done a lot of that, and I'm sure many in this room have, also probably know that it doesn't really ultimately satisfy our deepest longing. There's something too passive about it, right? You're just sort of taking it all in. You know, how much travel can you do before it's sort of like, okay, more great scenery, more beautiful 14,000-foot peak, so there's another one. At a certain point, it's sort of this passive exercise, as wonderful and enriching as it might be. And again, I think because there's something in us that's trying, that's tuned into this larger thing that's going on, creativity, evolution. Okay, number three. We could express our creativity. Take up painting. Write the great American novel. Perform music. Become a great pianist. Now, this probably feels a bit warmer, right? Because in some sense, it's more generative. We're participating in creation. We're creating things, maybe things of beauty, things that other people will be enriched by, which is why that's a more deeply satisfying experience for all of us than mere accumulation either of stuff or experience. There's something about participating in this creative unfolding that brings us alive. But if the context of that creativity is still just what I would call mere self-expression, just I'm creating to create, again, it tends to fall a little short of the ultimate mark, as much richness as it might bring to our lives. Number four, we could pour our energies into service. Now, of everything I've said so far, that probably sounds the warmest, right? Because, you know, helping those in need or trying to save the planet from demise, these are clearly things that need to happen in the larger evolutionary story that we're a part of. And again, I think it's probably why when we're doing that is actually when we feel the best. We probably feel the most alive when we're really deeply giving to something that we care about and something that's in need. But again, I would bring us to the question of context. What is the context in which that service and giving is occurring? Are we simply trying to patch up holes on a sinking ship? Or are we building the ark that's going to carry humanity forward on its evolutionary journey? You see, what I think we need to be doing, what I think is an organic response to those couple of pieces of knowledge I tossed out tonight about who we are and what our role is here, I think that what's an organic response to that, what we would naturally be doing if we really came to grips with that, is using our immense powers of consciousness and creativity that we all individually possess to do whatever we possibly can to move evolution forward. Consciously participating in what I really feel is the great work of our time. What Andrew Cohen calls the Universe Project. You see, in a very real sense, humans are, as far as we know, and I guess I should add one caveat, on Earth, because I don't know if there are extraterrestrials. For all I know, there are civilizations that are a million years ahead of us. Butch and I were having this conversation the other day. It's like, who knows? But as far as we know, because that's what I'm dealing with, what do we actually know? As far as we know, we're the leading edge of the Big Bang. Of 13.7 billion years of evolution, we are the very tip of that process. And we have all those powers alive inside us. And now, we actually... Because you see, up until the human, evolution was proceeding unconsciously. It was just this unconscious unfolding dynamics. Now we have consciousness and we have choice. So we can choose to consciously evolve or not. And I'm saying we need to do it fast. So I think there is a work that's emerging that really requires our attention. So what do I mean by conscious evolution? Are we going to go through rapid conscious biological evolution, maybe sort of evolve another set of arms so we can be more productive, or X-ray vision? Probably not. Because you see, biological evolution takes eons, no matter how you slice it. It's a very slow process. Now, with the human, evolution has moved into the realm of culture and consciousness. And so when I talk about moving evolution forward, that's what I'm referring to. The evolution of our consciousness, of our interiors, and of our culture, which emerges from that. So I'm sure this idea of evolving our consciousness for some is going to sound kind of abstract, like, what does it mean to evolve my consciousness? My consciousness is my consciousness. How does it evolve? And it frankly is a huge topic, and one that I can only go into so much detail about in the few minutes I have left. But it is something I go into a lot of detail in the book I'm writing, in the class that I'm offering. And so if somebody's interested in it, we can go into it a lot more. But here I will talk just briefly about this work that I'm calling evolutionary spirituality. You see, apart from all of the social functions it has served, at the heart of religion has always been the mystical quest, the spiritual quest, the quest for enlightenment, for liberation, for salvation, for to become Christ-like, nirvana, what defined in many ways, at its essence is a belief that humans have, as the conscious, aware part of the creation, that we have this potential for holiness, for to become something extraordinary, something so much more than the ordinary human condition shows up as. And at the same time, this mystical perspective also says we have an innate lower nature. In Christianity, it's original sin. In the East, it's maybe the five poisons. whatever it is, we have this fallen part of ourselves, this part of ourselves that actually is destructive not only to us but to those around us. And that the goal of the spiritual path has always been to transcend our smallness, our lower nature, and become a pure reflection of the perfection of the Creator, the source of all that brought this into being. And in light of our new understanding of evolution, I'd just like to modify that perspective a little bit. You see, I would say that the traditions are absolutely correct, that we have an extraordinary, even cosmic potential that we're evolving toward. There are potentials emerging in humans. We've seen it in the great saints throughout the ages of something really glorious that's possible for a human being to become. And I think that all of us are on an evolutionary journey in that direction. I also think that the traditions were dead on about this idea that we have a lower nature. I'm going to say, and I'm sure this will go over great here, that Christianity was right about this idea of original sin. Not a very popular idea, I bet, here, is it? But I want to clarify that I don't think it was Adam and Eve's fault. You see, in an evolutionary context, what we've come to understand is that we are saddled with this bundle of inherited proclivities from our ancient evolutionary past that really don't serve us at all in our current world. But we're programmed with them. We're hardwired with them. You see, human beings evolved over immense tracts of time when life was unimaginably different than it is now. And we grew out of animals that lived completely different lives than we live now, but we still have those animal components inside us. We have a reptilian brain that carries all the pieces that we share with the reptiles. For instance, the sex drive. The lizards, the reptiles invented sex, and we still have that piece right there in us. We have a mammalian brain. We have a primate brain. And all of these are hardwired with ancient instincts that may or may not be any good for the lives that we're trying to live now as civilized, evolving, culturally sophisticated human beings. How many people, how many men, kind of reasonably well-intentioned men who were in, you know, relationships that they loved, destroyed those relationships because they just compulsively went out and decided to sleep with other women? Well, when you actually understand how it was back in our early evolutionary history, what they've learned is that it's really a very simple thing. It's not that men even thought, hey, if I go and have sex with more women, my genes will be more likely to spread into future generations. It wasn't like that at all. In fact, our early ancestors probably didn't even know there was a relationship between sex and pregnancy, apparently. That was a kind of late emergence. There are even some primitive human tribes they've found where they don't get that yet. Humans. So, but what happened was that the males that had sex with the most women, their genes were the ones that tended to saturate the gene pool more and more, to the point that the genes that made people want to sleep with many women were the ones that everybody ended up with. It's really simple. And this is evolutionary biology. It, psychology. It also, and by the way, I'm not making excuses for you guys or myself, but I'm just saying there's a reason that that's there, and it has nothing to do with anything logical. I mean, it's perfectly logical for your genes, but not for your life. It's the same reason why women don't have that same tendency, because women could only have one child per year, roughly, and it was really important that the guy they chose, also because men, you know, aren't choosy. Men are really not choosy at all about who they have it with. It's just habit. But women are much choosier, and they really want to make sure that this guy is someone who's going to be there to help protect the kids so that it makes it to adulthood and spreads the genes. Not because they thought about it, but because the ones that were choosy were the ones that whose genes actually got spread. So these things are deep inside us. And really, somebody I was talking with at the little get-together we had last night was just pointing out that sort of all the seven deadly sins, if you look at them, they're all just old, inherited, you know, evolutionary proclivities. So So we've got a lot of evolutionary baggage that we need to overcome or transcend. And the most important piece in terms of this issue of conscious evolution is that there are a couple of tendencies that we inherited that are really working against us, more so than even the ones I just mentioned. We inherited a tendency toward short-term self-interest. We inherited a tendency to not really fundamentally, even though this whole thing of cooperation that I said is true about what's one of the engines of evolution, fundamentally we inherited from our past this basic sense of me and my survival. Extremely primitive stuff that's just built into us deeply. The other is that we inherited an intense resistance to change. An intense resistance to the unknown, to the new, the unfamiliar. Which makes sense, right? From back then, change meant more likelihood of death. Pretty simple. So keep the status quo. Keep things the same. Simple. The known, the familiar. Okay, that's built into us now. Have you ever noticed, for instance, on the self-interest point, have you ever noticed how hard it is to care for someone else, to genuinely care for someone else when you feel threatened? It's sort of like when we're happy, when we feel good and everything's great in our lives, it's really easy. We sort of, hey, I want to, you know, give you stuff and take care of people. We feel very generous. The moment we sort of feel like our own needs aren't being met and things are shaky, it's like, I don't care about you. I don't care about you. You know, it's me and my thing. Well, that's something we inherited. Have you ever noticed how hard it is to change? Like, even when you know you want to change, say, like, dieting or something, or you know, addiction. People experience this a lot with substance addictions. They're committed. They know, it's destroying my life. I want to change. Go back to that. We are programmed to resist change. Now, if we agree that the purpose of life is to get on board with the evolution project, if that makes sense to us, can you see how both of these tendencies, short-term self-interest and the known, the familiar, don't change, are kind of radically working against this larger vision? So if we're going to be fit to be conscious agents of evolution, we need to find a way to transcend our resistance to change, our fear of the unknown, our rigidity, find a way to become fluid, adaptable, flexible, resilient, able to respond to whatever life throws at us easily, positively. We also have to transcend our egocentrism, our ethnocentrism, our tribalism, our nationalism, and really work to become true planetary citizens. And so, just as in the old religions, the highest calling was for a radical self-transcendence and purification so that we could know God directly, I think that in the new evolutionary spirituality, we also have a great mystical task before us as human beings. And it has three parts. One is to face this reality of how primitive our current evolutionary stage really is compared to where we can go. To face it both for the race as a whole, to just come to grips with this larger picture, and to see it honestly in all of its particulars in ourselves, how it shows up in our lives. To be willing to look and see, my God, I am a primitive ape, frankly, who's just got this brain, but I'm really a mess, and start to come to grips with that. Number two is, in that knowledge, to give our hearts and souls to the deep spiritual work of rising above our lower nature, our inherited proclivities. And number three is to stretch, to think and feel, and most importantly, act as planetary citizens. In all that we do, to stretch beyond our self-interest, to stretch beyond our tendency to just look after us and our family and our clan and our friends and our tribe and maybe our region and perhaps our nation, but certainly not the whole, to stretch beyond all that and realize that evolution is trying, it's seeking this larger unification. That's where it's going, and it's our job as conscious agents of that to help usher that into being. So, I'm getting toward the end here. I know it's been a long journey. Hopefully an evolutionary one. So, how is it that we're going to go against the momentum? Because in a sense, what I just described sounds pretty simple, 1, 2, 3. But I'm saying we have to go against the entire momentum of 13.7 billion years of evolution up to this point and try to go somewhere in some sense, that's really not what we're programmed to do. So how are we going to do this? How are we going to overthrow the tyranny of eons of conditioning, embrace change, expand our sphere of identity to embrace the whole? Is it just a matter of will, pure effort? Maybe we have to become like the great mystical ascetics who would self-flagellate themselves to try to get the lust to go away unsuccessfully, I think, most of the time. I don't think that's quite it. But I think it might take a lot of effort. Fortunately, though, evolution gave us a shortcut. You see, when confronted with the unknown, with chaos, with change, with the new, although we have a lot of deep resistance to change, isn't it true that there's also a part of us that's kind of excited by it? Like, have you ever noticed that, like when a project that you're working on, business project, or maybe you're on a trip and you're traveling and things suddenly fall apart, don't go according to plan, that one part of you is like, oh, damn, things aren't working and you're not going according to plan and you're frustrated and you're angry and all this conditioning is kicking into gear. And there's another part in there that's kind of like, I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder what's going to happen now. This is kind of cool. Totally unknown. All the agendas have suddenly been derailed. Where are we going to go? You see, despite our resistance to change, we nonetheless long for it because, frankly, we thrive on it. An interesting statistic from the organizational development world is that apparently what keeps employees working at a company is not many of the things we might think. It's not better salary. It's not more benefits. It's a growth-oriented environment where people feel like they're being provided an opportunity to continuously evolve and develop. You see, I don't think it's an accident that we feel most alive when we're growing and evolving, when we're confronted with challenges that require us to develop new capacities, to rise into new parts of ourselves that we haven't discovered before. Because that's when we're the most in touch with the evolutionary impulse at the heart of this whole affair. You see, it's my conviction that at the heart of every human being is a spark of that creative, incredible impulse that gave birth to this whole event and that's been driving it all along. And that if we can align ourselves with it, ground ourselves in it, get connected to it, that it'll give us all the inspiration, strength, and perspective that we need to do its higher bidding. You see, you have to remember where we came from. We are, after all, the eyes and the hearts of the Big Bang. We were there before it all began, and the creative evolutionary dynamics that have given birth to this entire event in all of its glory and diversity are now alive in us. And in a very real sense, I think that this creative dynamic is only now attaining the peak of its power because it's conscious. You see, evolution was incredibly powerful as an unconscious force. But now that it can become conscious, I think you know, we ain't seen nothing yet. You see, although the universe has been going for 14 billion years, the action is going to start happening now. So far, we've had three big bangs, right? We had the cosmic big bang that brought it all into existence. We had the big bang of life that brought this amazing possibility of life alive. We had the mind's big bang that brought forth the miracle of human consciousness, reflectiveness. And it's my personal belief that if enough of us take the leap that I'm speaking about and start to relate to our lives in the way I'm speaking about, we're going to find ourselves before too long in the midst of a fourth big bang. It's going to be the big bang of the human spirit. As we free ourselves from the shackles of our animal nature, from our short-term thinking, from our narrowness, our rigidity, our selfishness, our fear, and step up to our roles as true, conscious, enlightened co-creators of the future, we're going to witness a creative flourishing that makes those first three big bangs seem small by comparison. I think, frankly, this will be the word become flesh, not just in one person, but in the many. On a personal level, it'll be our salvation, our liberation. And I think we will have not only then come into our maturity as a species, but I think we will have found our place truly in the universe. We will have grown up and we'll know who we are and we'll know why we're here. And I think that the earth and the heavens will rejoice with us in the glory of what we're able to express. Thank you very much.
The next part of our discussions are always some of my favorite, where
Me
we
too.
Give you a chance for some Q&A for about the next 20 minutes or so. And the sky's the limit on your questions. I want to, before we start the question, I want to thank Greg for his evolutionary sex education portion of his speech. I now have closure on Bill Clinton. Okay, we want to hand you the microphone so that you can ask the question and be heard by everybody. So Butch and I will run around with the mic. Questions?
First of all, I really appreciated your talk, and I'm not sure my brain will function enough to make an intelligent question here, but you talked about the evolution of human spirit as the next Big Bang. And I guess my question is, do you see that as an evolution, a step-by-step, or do you see it as transcending, a leapfrog kind of approach?
It's a great question. I think it's probably going to be some of both. When you say, will it be step-by-step or a leap, do you mean for the species as a whole or for any given individual? Both?
Either way?
Okay. Well, you see, I think the potential exists for an extraordinary leap for all of us. And I think in reality, it often takes a lot of small little steps to get ready to take an extraordinary leap. The extraordinary leap part is, it has to do with this thing I was speaking about at the end, about the fact that there's actually a part of us. You see, this is really the great mystical insight, that there's actually a part of the human that did not participate, that does not participate in time, in a sense. There's a part of the human that is not conditioned. Some might call it our spiritual essence, our Buddha nature, our Christ essence, the God within, whatever. But there is a part of us that if we step into it, it's already free of all that biological conditioning. It's already completely uninterested, frankly, in those needs and drives of the sort of human biological organism. It's already on fire with this larger evolutionary agenda for humanity. And when you see the great saints, you know, some of whom have lived in current times, some ancient times, but they were manifesting this. They were showing up in a way that it just was a radical break from human life as we know it. And this incredible possibility for just immense care for the whole, complete abandon of self-concern, and a kind of creative, inspired fire burning in them. So, and all of them have said, this is everybody's potential. This exists in you. This exists in all of us. And can't you just wake up to it? But they've often had a hard time getting people to wake up to it, which is why it's kind of a yes and no, because for most of us, we have to, I mean, just taking the baby steps of starting to face what a mess we are is a big deal. Most of us, my fiance Claire, who does a lot of work in transformation with women, you know, has often said, you know what, it's almost the hardest thing to do? To get people to see their own flaws, their own conditioned nature, their own negative parts of themselves, without using that as a way to create a negative identity that they then fixate on and feel bad about themselves and therefore don't change. So there is some great piece of work to be done to simply get to a place where you can look, and this is partly why I think this evolutionary perspective helps us, because it's hard work to get to a place to where we can simply say, wow, look at what I'm full of. I'm full of drives that would destroy my life if I let them run it, and sometimes I do, and it does, and wow. And to be able to live with all that, but without going, oh, I'm a bad person, oh, I've got problems, but to actually creatively engage that and say, I want to evolve beyond it. And I think seeing it in an evolutionary context, realizing it's part of our inherited nature, it's not personal to us, is one thing that can help maybe bring us closer to that leap. So, well, next, you guys decide.
I'll try to put this in a brief form as I can, Craig, but you speak of cultural evolution that we need to be engaged in and sort of how to go about that, but you also speak of our lower nature, which we see personified in our social structures, our political structures.
Absolutely.
Particularly the tendency toward short-term self-interest, whether it be in the political, the military-industrial complex, the business world, wherever. The corporate executives becoming immensely wealthy, et cetera. I mean, there's many, many examples.
Sure.
And also the intense resistance to change. We're still building in the military forces to fight World War II again, only better.
Right.
How do you transform the link between cultural to social and political that will make a real change? Because many of the lives we work with, I worked in social ministry after 30 years in the military, where the people's focus was on, where's my next meal coming from? How am I going to put a roof over my kids' heads? How am I, you know, that's here in America, in Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get from cultural to social and political?
Great. Beautiful question. There's one important kind of piece, I guess, I want to bring into that inquiry, which is that, you see, my talk tonight is not a talk for humanity as a whole. You see, humanity as a whole is spread out across a spectrum of evolutionary development. And there are many people with us now who are stuck in really some what I might call really old levels of cultural development. For instance, you know, fundamentalist Islam. We look at that sort of cultural meme, that way of relating to the world. Fundamentalism in any form, frankly. We see its narrowness, its rigidity, its smallness, its lack of context, its exclusiveness, right? It's probably easy for all of us in this room, I would guess, to see that. But for somebody who's in that worldview, that's what helps them get through the day. That's what gives them a sense of meaning. And so, if we were to try to say, how do we help people who are in a fundamentalist, exclusionary worldview move forward, it wouldn't be talking to them about what I'm talking about tonight. They'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? Evolution? Hi, I'm going to kill you. You know, it's, you know, but can we help them? Can we help every level of evolution move forward? We absolutely can. And the best insights from the cultural evolutionists are that the way you help, to grapple with cultural evolution, what you have to really understand is that there are very distinct phases that cultures move through, and that you can't skip stages. And that the only way you get any stage, can nudge any stage forward, is to give it sort of positive messages from the stage just slightly beyond it. And that there's a part of us, because we have this evolutionary drive in us that's trying to keep moving, when we hear something that's just a little bit beyond us, we kind of go, oh, yeah, that's because there's something about our current stage that's frustrating us. That's always the case. There's something about whatever we're in, however great it is, that's always, it's got its frustrating parts. And when we hear the next thing, it's usually the solution to those problems. So you take those people, and frankly, the simple answer that's often been given to how do we, say, deal with that problem is that no two countries with the golden arches have ever gone to war against each other. And I'm not saying McDonald's is the answer, but my point is that what actually is probably the answer there is not trying to give them some radical liberal message about participating in higher evolution like I'm talking about tonight, but is something more like giving those young guys some opportunities to participate in commerce and be productive so that they aren't just going and you know, don't feel that life's futile and I might as well go and kill myself anyway, and maybe I'll get 40 virgins on the other side. You know, you give them an opportunity to participate in the next stage of evolution, which is science, commerce, you know, what. Anyway, I'm not going to get into all the names of the stages. It's too complex. But the simple answer is you've got to take on the whole, if you want to really evolve culture, you have to see all the different levels that exist, nested one on top of the other, and you have to start providing evolutionary drivers at each level, and then you can see that these things do move. What do gang members who are lost in this very primitive, egocentric, violent, kind of, you know, out of control, rebellious kind of state of mind, what actually serves them is really well is fundamentalist Christianity. They found that those people who are lost in that just kind of pure self-interest, when they come in contact with fundamentalist Christianity, they sort of become kind of humbled by something bigger than themselves. They realize there's a law to life that they're supposed to line up with. They start to straighten out. So see, each of these things serves its part in the evolutionary unfolding. So anyway, incredibly complex question. I hope I answered it in some way. But okay, yeah.
Craig, I can't help but think that you might perform an experiment on your own. As you were talking about each of us having sort of a center in us that strives to be more godlike, and then you spoke of the history of the saints. Now, if truly humankind is evolving, all you would have to do to prove that, in fact, we are evolving is to count the number of saints that appear over equal periods of time. And if, in fact, more saints are appearing as time evolves, that sort of is the QED of your supposition here, is it not?
I think it's a great, in theory, it's perfect. It would be very hard to carry out because part of what makes a saint has to do with the eyes to recognize a saint, right?
And the definition of sainthood might be evolving as well.
Right. And I mean, you know, we had these great saints of the past. We don't know a lot about their personal lives. These days, most of our great, you know, spiritual leaders from all the traditions seem to have a lot of problems with that one particular thing I mentioned about men. We don't know if that was the case back then or not, but that's tended to bring them down from the level of sainthood pretty quickly. So I think it's hard to carry out, but I love the idea because, I mean, there may be some way you could track that. Interesting.
Get a show of hands.
How many of you are saints? Maybe that'll be a start. Okay, I think objectively that this high a concentration of saints exists in Chaffee County. It proves my point. Thank you.
I have another question here.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the series for bringing you here. And for me, the Big Bang of the soul and the spirit has already occurred. You know, from Columbine to Katrina to the daily events. You know, it's just series and like-minded people like you and this collection of people that there's hope that this will get back to the elementary schools because the children of today have got to be in just total fear. And the whole ethic committee needs to be redefined and replaced.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Craig, there's a pessimistic bone in my body saying that cultural evolution is going to take some time. But technological evolution might keep that from happening. It almost seems like that the human race is hell-bent on destroying itself either very quickly or very slowly, either through a big explosion or through so many of us on this planet that we can no longer feed ourselves. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm therefore pessimistic that technological evolution is so outpacing cultural evolution that we will never have a chance to try what you are hoping we'll get to. Thoughts?
God, I hope it's not true. I don't know. I mean, I guess Because the thing is, there's certainly a lot of reason for pessimism at this point. I mean, let's just take a little poll here. Okay, so let's just say, how many of you think, we have more than a 50% chance of making it through the next millennium? Let's start there. Wow, the majority, that's cool. Optimists. Okay, how many people think we probably have more than a 50% chance of not making it through the next millennium? Quite a show. Probably, I'd say it was probably about 60-40 or something. 60-40 toward the optimists. So, well, that's cool. I'm an optimist, too. I'm an optimist. I'm a utopian, right? Look what I was just talking about. But honestly, there's enormous cause for pessimism. And my own optimism, utopianism, really just comes from, it comes from the perspective that I'm laying out here, which is just the reality that we're just getting started, that we have this incredible potential, and that if anything's going to stop us from blowing ourselves up, it's waking up to who we are and what we can become. And so again, for me, really, in a sense, I guess what I would say to you is, because again, my message isn't for humanity as a whole, it's really for the kind of people who have the luxury and freedom to come and listen to lectures like this and take it home and think about it and think about how it might apply to their lives, because they're not just scraping to get food on the table. I would say pessimism's a choice and optimism's a choice. And in some sense, we just have to kind of make that choice, because there's no way to know for sure. If you sat down and you decided to spend a year amassing a body of evidence to prove that we were going to go to hell in a handbasket in the next probably 10 years, you could scare the crap out of this whole room if you just laid it out, because there are so many wild cards in the system right now. You know about nanotechnology, the potential that we're now starting to create intelligence at such a tiny microscopic level that we're going to be creating these little nanorobots that can do immense good. They're going to be able to put them into our bodies, they say, probably in the next 15 years, and they'll be able to, little mini computers, go in, detect disease and then kill the disease, all remote controlled, from the outside. I mean, incredible advances, potentially. They also say, also some terrorists could get a hold and create some nanobots that could go up and destroy all the oxygen in the atmosphere and we'd all die. And all this is kind of feasible at this point from the point of view of the technologists. So that's just one. Messing with the genes could screw things. I mean, there's so many things that could bring us down. And at the same time, I guess, given that I've got to choose one or the other, I'm going to put all, I'll just say being an optimist gives you a lot more energy to do something about it. And so we have a moral obligation to be optimists. If we have the luxury to attend lectures like this, we have the moral obligation to be optimists and be doing everything we possibly can to try to make sure we don't kill ourselves. Thank you.
Craig, as I was listening to you talk about what I'll call the me generation, my word, not yours, but how we have all become focused, I couldn't help but think, geez, that's a very now generation Western world orientation. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't know all the history of all the world's cultures, but I have a feeling that that statement applies more to, particularly to us in the United States, but as a generality in the Western world as to other parts of the world, or before the last 40 years. It seems like the last 40 years have turned into more of a self-focus as opposed to the doing things for the greater good.
Are you speaking about my idea about short-term self-interest, or are you speaking more about what I was saying earlier about sort of I've got my truth and you've got yours? Or the later piece about that we're all inherited this sort of tendency towards short-term self-interest.
That one, yes.
Okay. Well, there's a great truth in what you're saying, which is that we are by far the most narcissistic culture that's ever existed as human beings, no doubt. And in a way, it's a byproduct of the incredible advance we've made into autonomy, because it's really been only in the last probably couple hundred years, even 100 years, that the kind of sense that I'm an autonomous, a self-authoring person who can choose my own life, that I'm not beholden to a church, to my nation, to even my family. I can be my own person. That itself is a radically new thing, and it's a great advance, and it's something we also need to advance beyond pretty quickly, because it is incredibly breeds narcissism and self-centeredness like we've never seen. I mean, it's rampant.
It breeds fundamentalism too, where my own self-interest may be to go blow you up.
Hmm. Yeah, it could contribute, but to that, I mean, fundamentalism, though, tends to be more not so much me-focused, but tends to be more me and my group-focused. And we are against you, and therefore we're going to blow you guys up. So anyway, but I think this, in terms of your larger point, the thing is, I think that in spite of that, my point is really that we grew out of animals, and we are just deeply saddled with a basic drive to a real narrowness of identity. And either it's self-identity, or it's me and my family, or maybe it's me and my tribe. But to have a kind of identity that's genuinely inclusive of the whole is itself, it's a radically new thing. And I think it's only going to be those of us who have moved into that state of individuation and then step beyond that are going to be able to actually embrace the whole in a true way. I think the largest thing we had before this was probably, maybe God and country. And that's certainly not the whole, at least not the whole I'm aware of. But anyway, thanks.
I have a question about, Christ talks about dying to self, and when we lose ourselves, we find something eternal that we can be part of. And I guess I definitely hear that. We let go. I guess the question is, in your mind, if we as individual souls let go, do you think that we're part of a state that is eternal in the universe? Do you think we exist beyond ourselves, beyond our bodies?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I guess what I would say is that, and what you're speaking about really is the heart of mysticism fundamentally, which is the ability to transcend self and partake, in the source of the whole thing. I think that if we let go of self in the way you're talking about, that we can't help but find ourselves consciously experiencing the ground that is timeless and primordial, that there is what's known as the ground of being, people call it by different names, but it's the part of us that was never touched by time. And it actually is a part of every human being's consciousness. There is a part of it that never participated in the world of time. It never participated in your personal story. And when you discover it, you realize you're discovering something that's essentially true for all human beings. It was here before the universe was born, and it'll be here when the universe is gone. It's bigger than all of it. It's the transcendent. And I absolutely believe, from my own experience and from the experience of mystics across the ages, that this is a real thing. It's something science will never be able to study or touch, even if it can tell us what our brains are doing when we're having that experience. absolutely so. I also think, though, that, and what's got me turned on right now, there's an additional piece to that that I think is really critical, which is that, in a sense, we could say the old mysticism, the eternal mysticism, is about going beyond time and space to discover the eternal. But the evolutionary mysticism is perhaps what we might call going beyond the surfaces to partake in what we might call the creative face of God. Because in a sense, you might say God has two parts. There's that static, eternal presence, and there's the creative dimension of it that has given birth to this whole thing. And we have the potential to partake in both. And I think when we step into what I'm talking about here, we start to really become the living manifestation of the creative face of God. and in that, that is it's another kind of holiness. Honestly, I think we need both. If we're going to have a true spiritual path, we need to have the ability to disappear into the ground, and we need to have the ability to actively, passionately, full-heartedly participate in creation, in continuous creation. Because God didn't make this thing once and go away. Whatever God is, it's alive right now, and its best shot at showing up and having any impact is through us. So.
All right, is there one more question? Warren.
Thanks for coming, Craig. I am a little disturbed about the fact that we males evolved out of turtles.
No. In parallel. That's the magic. We evolved out of mammals. Same thing, but
from turtles.
No.
It's going to keep me up tonight.
No, parallel lines.
That's even more disturbing. I'm an academic, and I was just wondering, when I think about evolution, I think about those who have evolved intellectually and those that haven't. Hmm. And I can't wait for a big bang for my students to evolve intellectually. nor can society. We can't afford it. Is there some kind of action plan that not only myself but others might be able to engage others who have either disengaged or don't have the optimism that, yes, I can succeed? How do we get them to evolve a little more quickly? And not just overnight, but I usually have a semester.
Well, what do you do? Hang on to the mic. So you're an evolved intellect.
Well, I'd like to think of myself as evolving.
Yeah.
But I get a lot of strokes from my peers. And so...
But I mean, what do you do with your students in this short period that you... I'm just curious, given the... Obviously, it's something you've been working with.
Well, I try to introduce them to other people who have evolved and get them in touch with them, not just their peers, but people from the outside who we perceive have more experience, more wisdom, higher intellect. That seems to work.
Okay.
Maybe the question ought to be, how do I get my peers to evolve?
Oh. Evolving academia. Okay.
Yeah.
And tell me, what is the problem that you see there? Because, I mean, I agree, there's a lot of rigidity.
I have to say, and I'll put in a plug for Colorado Mountain College, that's an institution that has enormously evolved over the years and doesn't subscribe to the theory so much that it's what you learn, but how you learn and how you go about learning. It's more than philosophical. It's a prescription for about a lot of things spiritually as well. But I may just be going over to the prison next semester. How do I either dummy down or dummy up your presentation to get to those that have not evolved at all, but seem to be regressing backwards?
Wow. Well,
don't ask me another question, please.
No, I won't. You tell me how you do that. Well, I guess what I'm wondering is whether, given the if you're talking about, say, people in prison, whether this message is exactly the one, again, that is really for probably the next step for them. I'm not sure. If you've been there, you probably have a better sense of where the consciousness is at, but I might imagine something a bit more rudimentary one thing I am aware of is that there are a lot of people in prison. Something that happens to people in prison where they suddenly have, it's kind of almost a monastic thing, even though obviously it's hell, but they have all this time on their hands, and I can tell you, because I have worked at this magazine, What is Enlightenment, for many years, and we would, I guess somehow these magazines would get into the prison libraries, and we'd get these letters from prisoners who were incredibly introspective, who were really saying, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm really coming to grips with my spiritual nature and realizing, you know, I've made such a mess and I'm really turning. So there is a kind of thing that happens for the rare person in there that goes into a kind of almost monastic kind of mindset and reads everything they can possibly read about spirituality and philosophy and try to really enrich themselves. So obviously, if you have some of them, you can feed them the higher stuff. But I would imagine perhaps more for a lot of folks in prison is they need some, I don't know, you know, more just sort of basic kind of texts of optimism and, you know, positive thinking and how you can take control of your life, how you can, books about discipline, about how to, because what do those people probably lack a lot of? Discipline, ability to restrain themselves from doing things that are going to destroy their lives yet again. So, I don't know. I mean, this is a very complex question. We can talk more about it afterwards. I don't want, but I'm just thinking that probably for people like that, you need different messages for different people at different levels. So, I don't know. In terms of your students at large, I don't know. Get me afterwards. We'll brainstorm it together.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks. You, Craig, for coming tonight. Let's give Craig a big round of applause.
Thank you.
Wow. That might be the Forum Series' first standing O.
Really? Wow. I'm humbled.
Anyway, thank you all for coming. Craig is lecturing again tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. here at the same place. If you would, you know, be so inclined and you want to fill out a feedback form tonight, we'd appreciate that. Thank you all for coming. Have a safe drive home, and hopefully we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
What's your vision of Apple?